will go above 50 megahertz in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the confines of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this Rain Report. If you were an avid VHF contester in the early 2000s, you probably recognize the name Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ, an inveterate VHF contester who, for a time, authored the QST magazine column, The World Above 50 MHz. Reading from a 2012 obit about Gene from the Washington Post, Eugene M. Zimmerman, Gene, age 71, passed away June 3, 2012. He was born on June 27, 1940, in New Haven, Connecticut. A graduate of Yale University, he earned his Ph.D. in microbiology from the University of Maryland in 1968. He worked at the NIH, the National Institute of Health, for 35 years, starting in cancer research, moving to grants administration, and then lastly to allergy and immunology study. His passion was ham radio, first licensed in 1956. He was a life member of the American Radio Relay League, very involved with contests, and wrote the popular QST column, The World Above 50 MHz. His call letters were W3ZZ. And so he was in 2008, when Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, caught up with Gene at the Digital Communications Conference that summer in Chicago. The following excerpt came from a recently unearthed interview with the late Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ.
I was a ham radio SWL in high school, which means that I went around and instead of listening for foreign broadcast stations, I listened for hams. And for reasons that are unclear to me, I never took the license. I had a friend who was also interested. He never got licensed also until he got to college. When I got to college, I joined the college radio club in 1956. I joined in September, and I got my novice license in December. The guy who was the big driver in the radio club at that time was a very brilliant astronomy graduate student, a guy named Jim Douglas, W2BMF. Jim has since passed on, I understand, although I lost track of him for a long time. He was actually a radio astronomer, and not just an astronomer. He really understood electronics theory. So that's where I really learned electronics theory, and I guess I then understood it wasn't so hard to get a license. So I got novice license in December of 1956, and the novices had crystal control privileges on 15, 40, and 80, and two-meter phone. I did all of those, actually, and in May of 1957, I got my general class ticket. I became K1ANV.
Back when the novice license was only good for a year.
That's correct. It was good for a year, and the novice class began, I believe, either in 1952 or 53. It hadn't existed for all that many years at that point. I was originally drawn in two directions, well, more than two directions. When I was young and I was in college, I was a traffic handler. In fact, I used to occasionally be the net control for the transcontinental phone net. I did most of my traffic handling on phone, which was not considered the right thing to do. Everyone did it on CW. But this was an AM phone net, and because we had a dipole on top of a building that was about 150 feet high, 4 o'clock in the morning when this net met, you could work a long way. And when you'd collect all the traffic from the East Coast, you'd pass it out to a guy in St. Louis, and he'd pass it on to the West Coast. This was all done on 75-meter phone. You got to realize equipment wasn't as good then as it is now. And so talking regularly to somebody 1,200 miles away, 1,000 miles away on phone was really a feat. The old theory exams had things like push-push doublers and Faraday shields. You read about those only in books, except the equipment that we had in that radio club was so old, it actually had these things. The tuner had a Faraday shield because it produced huge amounts of TVI, and this cut it down about 10 dB. The transmitter was built before 15 meters existed. That's a fairly new band. as you may remember. The VFO that he used was a Meissner signal shifter, also known as a signal drifter, and it produced a horrible note. So I built a new VFO for it, and to get it on 15 meters, I used a push-push doubler. And I built the VFO as if it were a VFO for sideband, a mixing VFO, even though this was an AM transmitter. And I don't remember to this day why I did that, except that was an easy way, because if you had 10 megahertz signal to start with, that was an easy way to get to 15 meters. 10.5 times 2 is 21. 10.5 to 10.7 is the range, and you just doubled. It was a pair, the output of that VFO went to a pair of 1625s, so those are 12-volt 807s. And to get it to a push-push doubler, there was a switch that would turn on the other tube. It was a single tube, except when it was acting as a doubler, then it was two tubes. The main band we operated was 15 meters because we had an enormous 15-meter antenna, probably a lot bigger than anyone has today. We, as the Yale Radio Club, the Yale Astronomy Department, was interested in listening to non-thermal noise just below 21 megahertz. On top of this building, they put up four poles about 30, 40 feet tall. They had four 8-element 15-meter beams. These are, I don't know, 50-foot booms. And they had alt-azimuth mounts. They could be raised and point at any point in the sky. On a building about a block away, they built four more and operated them as an interferometer. We didn't use the ones a block away. You know, feed lines weren't so low loss even on 15 meters in those days, but we did use the four on the roof. I remember one day working three legitimate stations in Burma on the same day in the summer. There were only four that ever were legitimate, except for a few expeditions. And I worked three of them in one day. Didn't work them for myself. I wasn't too smart for many years.
So what happened after college?
After college, I went to graduate school. And during this time in college, and also when I was getting my master's, I also got interested in VHF. And I never had much of a station from home, but we did go out portable. We had a big portable station. It was originally all plate-modulated AM. That's really a big deal, because when you lug that up a mountain, you're carrying a 500-watt modulator up that mountain. You work pretty hard.
You're listening to an excerpt from a previously unreleased interview with the late Gene Zimmerman, W3ZZ, inveterate VHF contester and popular QST author of The World Above 50 MHz column. We'll conclude Hap's conversation with Gene in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available, for now anyway, on www.therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Eventually, I moved down to Washington, D.C. area. I spent a year working at the National Institutes of Health as a technician, and then I went on and got my Ph.D. By this time, I had gotten very interested in HF contesting. We're talking about mid to late 60s. I belonged to what was then, and still is, one of the premier contest clubs, Potomac Valley Radio Club in Washington, D.C., and the first 10 years I was there, essentially, from 64 to 74, I think except for one year where I got sick, for 9 years I finished in the top 10 in the United States. Very difficult to do from the East Coast. This is in the sweepstakes. This is all bands. But it's very difficult because you're in the middle of all the activity. And the station that I used was extremely strong, except on 75 meters. It was very strong in Europe, but it wasn't very strong in the States. The guy deliberately designed the antenna, so it didn't do well in the States. It's a long wire, 1,000 feet long, it was 150 feet high, and it was pointed at Europe. When I moved to Washington, I stopped doing VHF. Still interested, but I didn't have a place to do it. I bought a house in 1972, got married. Occasionally, I'd work VHF, but I really didn't seriously get back in like I was when I lived in Connecticut until 1981, and I've been very active since that time.
When did you get into writing?
Oh, I guess I've always done some writing. I have a PhD in microbiology. I've always enjoyed teaching, but I've written things for clubs. I got involved in the HF contest business. I used to write a column about VHF contesting for a magazine called CQ Contest, which is now defunct, and I wrote that for several years. Let me go back and say that I had built a good VHF station, not so much as a contest station, although I finished in the top five in the United States several times. But in 1994, a friend moved to the Washington area, and I've never really operated seriously from home since then. We've always gone out portable. Portable is what I like. I'm not physically able to put stuff up like I used to, but I have done it. We've done very well, starting from scratch in 1994. We've been together for 15 years. We've won the ARRL contests four times.
Speaking of the ARRL, how did you get the job becoming the writer?
My predecessor, W3EP, Emil Pocop, decided in 2002 that at the end of the year he was done. He'd done it for 10 years. And he replaced Bill Tynan, you know Bill. And Bill did it for 20 years, or almost 20 years. He's W0WOI now, and I've forgotten what Smitty's call was when he wrote it. He wrote it for about 6 or 7 years. Before him was my hero, Sam Harris. And that's the reason I took this job, is that Sam was my hero. Now, when I was a teenager, we used to go up there. My friends would sit in the kitchen with his wife, Helen, and his son, and talk about 6 meters. And I'd sit out in Sam's shack, especially in the winter, while he showed me how to work 80 and 160 meters. People don't realize he was a great 80-meter DXer. Plus, he had one other interesting facet. He was the only person in the world who remembered about beverages. It had disappeared from the face of the earth. And I was too stupid to ask him what it was. He said, oh, these are just receiving wires. He's a funny guy. If you asked him, he would have done it. But he didn't. I didn't ask him, and he didn't tell me, and so for 10 years I could have had a secret that would have made me invincible in the DX contest. Sam was the VHF editor for about 7 years, and before him, 25 years since the column started, was Ed Tilton, W1HDQ, who's of course very famous. But those are the only people who've ever done it. So they called me up, and they said, would you like to do this? And I'm saying, well, I'm retired now. Do I want to do this? Sam Harris did this. I ought to do it for a while. It's a lot of work because you have to come up with new ideas all the time, but it's fun too.
The focus of your column.
It's 50 megahertz and above, and it's a column mainly about operating, not technical stuff. Now, some of the editors have put technical stuff in there. Tilton was a staff member, and he built things. That was his job for the league, to include in QST, and occasionally talk about them in the column. Sam Harris, of course, was a great EME guy. He built stuff too, but the others, although they have building talents, the column evolved over the years into a column about operating. What's happening on these bands and why? I do talk about some technical things, but I don't talk about the microwaves except for microwave operating, because there is a column called Microwavelengths. It's a very good column. I think W1GH said now writes it. And he's a microwave engineer and a very good one. So I don't touch on his stuff very often. It's mainly about operating. And I'll talk about contests and I'll talk about band openings. And if there's been a very good band opening, I'll analyze it. I'll get all my reports together and I'll make maps and I'll tell people about it.
Did the link contact you?
Yes, they did.
And you were hesitant?
I was hesitant only because it's a big commitment. But I think that my association with Sam Harris sealed the deal. As I said, he was my hero. And I figured if he could do it, I could do it. He was a pretty busy guy in his day.
You might talk a little bit about Sam Harris.
Sam was an interesting fellow. I don't know if he even had a college degree. But in his day, He was the world's expert on the construction of parabolic dishes, both their design and their mechanical construction. To the best of my knowledge, nobody built a large dish. For instance, the dish at Arecibo, a 300-foot dish, a lot of that's his design. Not all, but nobody ever designed a dish without consulting him.
And that concludes our excerpt from a 2008 conversation Raines Hap-Holly, KC9RP, had with well-known VHF contester and QST writer Gene Zimmerman, who became a silent key in 2012. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, and looking for a data recoverer that would be willing to restore a now non-responsive portable hard drive that has all the 2016 Dayton Hamvention audio forums that Rain relies so heavily on for program material throughout the years locked up on it. Hap has been quoted a price by Gilware in Madison, Wisconsin of $1,000 to have those audio files professionally recovered. If we can't recover those files, the future of these Rain reports will be in serious jeopardy. For more background about the dire situation Rain is in, check out a Rain special report that will be posted shortly. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2016 Rain. All rights are reserved. Now, for you, our patient listeners and affiliates. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, and this is the Radio Amateur Information Network.